It's 5:06, and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Rob Thurrott. Coming up later in the program, we'll talk about how email is swallowing our lives and what we can do about it.
First, though, we've talked a lot about drunk driving on the program recently, but that's not the only stubborn problem among Wisconsin drivers. Distracted driving, including texting while driving, has also been a huge issue for the state and nation as well.
And this week, filmmaker Werner Herzog lent his voice to the cause. In a new documentary, From One Second to the Next, Herzog hears from drivers, victims, and their families who've been affected by texting and driving. Let's take a listen.
I saw, you know, the windshield just glass broke and screeching, and my head, you know, it happened in about a second. I mean, I had 1,000 thoughts going through my mind. As I started coming to a stop, I saw, you know, a body come down from off the top of the van. And I just thought, oh my gosh, what have I done? What have I done?
That's pretty powerful, but is it enough to curb the high rates of distracted driving around the nation? And what else can be done?
Joining us now is Pam Moen, Assistant Vice President of Public Affairs at AAA Wisconsin. Pam, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much. I appreciate the invitation.
Do you think big profile campaigns like this one make a difference when it comes to reducing distracted driving?
Absolutely. AAA actually did a study a few years back to determine what is the best approach to get drivers to actually stop texting while they drive. And this Herzog film that we're talking about supports some of the most effective approaches that were recommended by the AAA findings. Because we have this real disparity. The vast majority of drivers believe that distracted driving and texting while driving is a top safety concern and people shouldn't do it. However, many of those same people admit to texting and driving themselves. So we have this real disconnect about with drivers knowing that texting is dangerous and wrong, but they continue to do it anyway. So the big question is how do we change that behavior? And the approach taken by this film actually supports what AAA has found to be the most effective way to reach people with the message and get them to change their behavior.
Well, let's follow up on that. What are some of the most effective ways to reach out and change our behavior?
Really, there were four main things that came out of the AAA study. One is confronting drivers with the potential tragic consequences of choosing to do something they know is risky and wrong. Also, communicating the feelings of guilt and shame that are felt by the drivers who make those decisions and cause those crashes. We also found that using dramatic messaging, but not overly fear-based or graphic tactics is effective. And then lastly, enlisting those who are most impacted by distracted driving crashes to help deliver the message. And so as we look at this Herzog film, it really enlists all of those tactics that AAA has found to be among the most effective at getting this message through.
Yeah, watching that, I think it was a Milwaukee family they started with, a mom talking about her son and how she dreamed of him, of him being a football player, and watching him with the stands, how active he is. And then we find out he's crippled from basically the chest down after being hit by a driver who was texting while driving. Very, very powerful.
Yeah, it really is. It's heartbreaking and powerful testimony about the life-changing and sometimes life-ending consequences of making the choice to text while driving. And I watched the film, and all I can say is after seeing this film, no person should ever again be able to text and drive. It's really that powerful and that simple.
I know neither of us is a psychologist, as far as I know. Maybe you have a secret life on the side. But, you mentioned that disconnect in your research that everybody knows, or just about everybody knows, yeah, this is bad, yet a lot of them are still doing it. Why do you think there's that disconnect?
Well, it's that tendency for us to academically, we know it's wrong, we know it's dangerous, but we think we're okay. It's safe for me to do this because I'm a good driver, is I think what people tend to think. And as you watch this video, you'll see the drivers, including the young man from Indiana that you played the clip from at the beginning of the program. And he'll tell you, he did this every day on his way to work, and he thought he was safe. And it wasn't until he crashed into the back of that Amish buggy and killed three family members that he even knew he was in danger. And, he said things after the fact, like, I wish I could go back to that day and change my decision and not choose to text while driving. And he said nothing was that important, and things happened so fast, and now I have to live with the consequences of the choices I made that killed three people.
You just reminded me, we were talking about drunk driving on the show the other day, and our guest mentioned the Lake Wobegon effect, where when you poll drivers, everyone thinks they're majority of people think they're better than average drivers, and I can handle driving with a little alcohol, or I can handle driving while texting. Those other guys can't. They're losers, but I got it under control.
Right, and that's what everybody thinks until they have the crash, or they cause the crash that has these tragic consequences that can't be undone. That was the other thing that struck me as I watched the film, is just the permanence of the consequences of these decisions. All of them said, they would give anything to go back and do this differently, not make that choice to text and drive. And the problem is that doesn't become clear to people, apparently, until it's already done and not changeable. And that's what's so tragic. All of these crashes, all of these injuries, all of these deaths were absolutely preventable. And one of the young men that is featured in a different scenario on the video has really devoted his life to speaking to young people who are beginning their driving careers, and telling his story and telling them that it's hard to live with the fact that he killed two people, and he has to live the rest of his life with that, knowing that that crash was completely preventable. And he said what he tells people is it's really that easy to save someone's life. Just put the phone away when you're driving the car. And it truly is that simple. And for some reason, that does not resonate with many drivers, again, until they're involved in a serious situation. And once that happens, it's too late to change those consequences.
We're talking with Pam Moen of the AAA about distracted driving. We're prompted in large part by a new documentary, a half-hour documentary by famous film director Werner Herzog, just showing the lives of four people affected in one way or another by distracted driving, by texting while driving. Do we have a link to that, Chris, up on the Central Time Facebook page? He's giving me the thumbs up. Yeah, after the show, you can check that out. Very, very powerful stuff. Now we want to hear from you. You can give a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Do you want to admit to sometimes texting while driving? What do you think needs to happen to make it so that fewer people do that? 800-642-1234. Send an email to talk@WPR.org.
We'll take your calls right after the break. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks, Noah. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. We're continuing our conversation about texting and driving with Pam Moen, and we're taking your calls at 1-800-642-1234.
Have you personally been affected by distracted driving, by texting while driving? Do you want to share your story? And what do you think can be done to tackle the problem? 800-642-1234. We'll get to your calls in just a moment. But Pam, first, a lot of what we've talked about is the getting the message out idea. But how about the law and enforcement side? It's texting and driving is illegal in Wisconsin. Correct me if I'm wrong. How's that being enforced?
Right. That these personal testimonies that we're talking about are really a very effective way to get the message through about changing people's behavior and encouraging drivers not to text while they drive. But these testimonies go hand in hand with effective laws and enforcement. Here in Wisconsin, we do, of course, have a law that makes it illegal for anyone to text while they drive. And enforcement is an important part of that, but obviously law enforcement can't cite everyone who is texting behind the wheel. The law, a large benefit to the law is to actually raise awareness about the danger of the issue and encourage people to govern their own behavior and to drive safely, which includes choices to not text while driving. So certainly strong laws and enforcement are very important to this battle to against texting while driving. But the personal testimonies also are a key component of that. And that really plays into, overall, the need to change our culture that somehow has made it acceptable for people to text and drive. Similar to the issue we have with drinking and driving. Now, we in Wisconsin still have a lot more progress to make on that issue, but in many states in the country, the culture has been changed, and it really is taboo, unacceptable for people to drive after they've been drinking. Similarly, we need to change that thinking and change the culture where it's just inherent in us that we know it is unacceptable to text while we drive.
We'll go to our phones now at 800-642-1234. We have Rob in Madison, but not me. Another Rob in Madison on the line. Hi, Rob.
Hi.
What do you think about this?
Well, I think that there's a lot of things outside of sort of what your guest is talking about that I think are impacting this as far as the culture. So I think broadly, what we have right now in our culture for people who are doing these things while they're working, for example, is most people that I know are working for companies where they have to do a tremendous amount of communication with other people in the company. They also have to do a fair amount of driving, and they're really not given sufficient time to do either. So then they're looking at that immediate payoff of, hey, I can quote-unquote be more productive, which our society values, right? While traveling, and I get the payoff of them, I get to hang out with my kids and stuff like that, rather than putting in a bunch of extra time at work, versus the relatively low possibility that the horrible, horrible things that your guest is talking about could happen, which I'll admit, I've been moved that way myself before. I have done a couple texts while driving in the past, and always for work things, and I definitely think about it afterwards, like, wow, you just perhaps jeopardized somebody's life in order to shave 5 minutes off of your workday. But when that workday 5 minute shave off is for sure and immediate, and the chances of hurting somebody is very low, and we assume, of course, in the future, like you were saying earlier, happens to those other losers, not me, it's hard to follow that rule. It's kind of like being on a diet.
Gotcha. Gotcha. Thanks a lot for the call, Rob. A couple things there, I think. But it sounds like he's saying, one, you were just, Pam, talking about how the culture needs to change. He's saying maybe our corporate, our business culture, our employment culture needs to change to take some of that stress off, or at least discourage doing this.
Yeah, it's an excellent point that I don't disagree with. I think as we have become a society of multitaskers, because people are so busy, their lives are so hectic, and work is demanding more productivity from people, families demand more and more from each of us, and so we have become this society of multitaskers. Interestingly, though, there are some signs that our corporate culture is recognizing this as a problem. And in fact, in the last several years, we have seen some major corporations actually implement corporate policies that prevent people or restrict people from texting while driving or you know, using cell phones or other technology while they drive, because they recognize that that is contributing to the problem, this need that Rob described of people to be more productive, to get their work done while they're traveling or on the road. And corporations have recognized that they're contributing to the problem. Plus, frankly, it creates a lot of liability for companies. I mean, if your employee causes a crash that injures and kills someone while they're on company business and sending company emails or texts, that opens up your company to a lot of liability. And so corporations certainly are part of the problem, but are also recognizing that, and we're really pleased to see so many of them implementing changes in their company policies that lean toward the safety side of the equation as opposed to only the work productivity piece.
Thanks a lot for bringing that up, Rob. We'll go now to Brian in Wausau. Hi there, Brian.
Hey, how are you?
Good. What do you think of this?
I just was calling in to share an idea I thought of. I know phones have the ability to monitor speed because I have an app on my phone that monitors speed, and I was thinking if cell phone companies could devise a way to disable texting while the phone is moving fastly, so there was no opportunity for texting while moving.
Well, but that would block passengers too, right?
Yeah, but I mean, does everybody need to be texting all the time? I mean,
gotcha.
They can wait to a stop sign or whatnot. But,
okay. Well,
saving people's lives, I think, is more important than a constant convenience of communication.
Gotcha. Thanks a lot for the call, Brian. So are there either that, Pam, or other technological solutions that people are trying to work with?
There are, and the ideas that Brian has brought up, I mean, we've heard discussed now for several years. I mean, certainly there is the ability for technology providers or individuals to restrict the functions that the phone can do while the vehicle is in motion. But you raise the question. I mean, so then it's limiting everyone. If, you know, if you have a passenger and you need to have them, you know, place a call or look up directions or something, you know, so there are a lot of complications to solving this strictly through technology. But as technology will continue to evolve and play even more crucial roles in our daily lives, I mean, this is certainly an issue we have to address, because a different study that AAA released recently had to do with in-vehicle technology that was causing distractions. I mean, we've started installing technology in vehicles that make it more convenient for people to do, for example, voice-to-text scenarios or voice-to-text email. And what we've found is, you know, thinking that may be somewhat safer than actually doing the physical texting while driving, we found that the cognitive distraction caused by those kinds of interactions with vehicle technology can actually be more dangerous than talking on the phone or doing the physical texting. So while technology does have the potential to be a huge part of the solution, it also, frankly, creates some of the problems.
Time for one more call with Leanne in Minocqua. Leanne, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Say, I'm happy to report that I have never texted once.
Hooray.
While driving, or has my husband. I have a brother in Seattle who does not even own a cell phone. So I think of people like ourselves who are not guilty of this. And it's just really frightening. You see it every day. You see it all the time. People texting and driving. And it's really ironic. Everybody thinks they are multitasking and they're good at it. And nobody can do it. Nobody can multitask. Mm-hmm. You're actually making more work for yourself, I think. But I'm just wondering, it's not just kids. It's kids and adults. Mm-hmm. But I'm wondering in terms of kids and getting their license,
what are kids learning in driver's ed? Because it's
gotcha. Leanne, I'm going to cut in because we're just about out of time, and I want to give Pam a chance. What are they teaching about this in driver's ed?
Yeah, well, certainly distracted driving and particularly texting and driving is something that, if it's not, it should be addressed in all good driver's training classes. AAA has a driver's training program, and I know we spend a lot of time educating our students on the dangers of this activity. And, you know, unfortunately, these are young people that, you know, have grown up in a world where all of this technology and phones and texting is just really second nature as part of their lives. I mean, those of us who are middle-aged, I mean, remember the days when we didn't even used to have cell phones. And so I think we can resist that temptation sometimes more easily than the young people. But it's just so important that we all get the message out there that nothing is so important that it can't wait until you are safely done driving. And when you watch this video and you hear these stories, I mean, they will just break your heart.
Pam, thank you so much for being with us today. That was Pam Mohn, Assistant Vice President of Public Affairs at AAA Wisconsin. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll get another perspective on the news that more Wisconsin teachers have lost their jobs since Act 10 became law.
But first, we're talking about how email is swallowing our lives. Rob?
Yeah, it's a I feel like I'm always fighting a losing battle there. I'm up at, I think, 1,200 some in my inbox, and, you know, you pick away at it, but what do you do? Mm. Anyway, our guest looked at several studies on email use at the office, talked to some experts about how much time we're spending on email. Short version, it's bad. It's really bad.
Jennifer Senior joins us. She's contributing editor at New York Magazine. Welcome to Central Time.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
So how much time is the average worker really spending just trying to manage their email?
Well, the best number I found is that it's 28% of their time. So if you assume a 40-hour work week, which most people don't work, you know, they do more of that, but let's be conservative and say 40 hours, assuming they're employed full-time, 11.2 hours a week.
Wow.
Yeah.
that's more than a day.
It's more than 2 hours a day. And it doesn't include something that I thought was really interesting. A fellow also looked at, this is one of the founders of Sanebox, which helps you manage your email and filter them. He found that each email takes about 67 seconds to recover from, which I think does stand to reason intuitively. I mean, there is a certain head of steam that you get going, you're working on a project, and then your inbox pings, and you're diverted, and you have to deal with it. And it could take a long time. And he's not talking about the amount of time that you spend replying to the email. He's talking about the amount of time that you spend disengaging and then re-engaging, the kind of where was I stuff.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So if you consider that you kind of contend with about 75 emails a day coming into your inbox and multiply that by 67 seconds per email, that's an additional hour and 20 minutes or so per day. So it comes out to nearly 4 hours a day that you're kind of contending with emails in some way or another.
But it's all really important stuff, right?
No. I think, the industry consensus seems to be somewhere around the 40% mark, 42% mark, that those are the ones that are considered important. And, you know, they can range from, you know, your spouse saying, we need bread and pick it up on the way home, to something from your boss. And then a lot of it is, no, just stuff you can table. But, and, you know, you were mentioning like 1,200 emails sitting in your inbox, and maybe that's the 60% that you've, you know, been accumulating.
A lot of it is, but it feels like you've got to pay close attention to that email, because maybe there's something important, some grain in the chaff there, or somebody's going to be really ticked off at me if I don't give their email the proper attention and reply that it so richly deserves.
Yeah, exactly. There was a Harvard Business School professor whose name escapes me at the moment, but of course it will come to me in 10 seconds, who talked about the cycle of responsiveness, that the problem is that we're all kind of condemned to answer our emails very quickly if you're in a culture where everyone answers their emails very quickly. So if your bosses are in the habit of getting emails back very quickly from, you know, four of the employees that they work with, and you're the one who actually is civilized about it and eats their lunch first for instance, you know, it can be a problem. I mean, it can be a real problem.
Do you have a sense of how much email the average employee is receiving that isn't spam?
Spam is a really low percentage. It's something like, I'd have to look it up, but it's not more than about 10 or 12%. I mean, most of the emails are not spam. They just wouldn't necessarily be deemed essential. You know, they're things that can wait. And that I would suspect, although I don't have any, you know, I don't think anybody's done a controlled study that looks at this, but that I would suspect are more quickly dispensed with a phone call. Also, you know, a lot of these things are useless CCs. You're kind of, you know, you're being notified, but you don't really need to look at these things.
So it seems like there's a few categories here. There's the really important stuff that we're glad we got, want to reply to it. There's stuff that we can kind of delete on site.
Yep.
I think for a lot of people, you wrote about, and in my life, the big problem is that middle ground. Like, that's probably important. It would probably benefit me to read that, but I don't need to do it right now, and that's where the inbox builds up. Has anybody come up with a system to tackle that and to deal with that sort of sludge that slowly builds up?
Yep. There are a bunch of companies that do that, and, you know, you can sign up for their services. You can, you know, do some of it online. What winds up happening is that some people use color coding so that you can, like, kind of rate your emails. I mean, to me, it seems very intimidating because I don't want to spend any more time. I don't want to spend time thinking about categorizing my emails, but I'm sure if I ever bothered to plug myself into a system, it would be more efficient. I mean, you know, there's this whole movement to get to zero inbox, and this is the way they do it. You know, you color code your what's flowing in. There are some systems you can sort of you can enable that will stagger your emails. So you don't get them every time they land. You get them at 3-hour intervals or at 2-hour intervals or at the end of the day, however you want to do it. So yes, there are technologies that can do this for you. I don't want to name them now because that's kind of plugging one particular company. But yes, there's no shortage of them out there.
Well, I'm sure there are some behavioral things we could do on our own too. First of all, maybe changing our mentality, our attitude about email.
I think that's totally true. I think also, just based on the comment thread from my post, from my essay about this, a lot of people talk about the fact that their bosses have kind of these outsized expectations. So my suspicion, in a way, is that employers have to also change the way that they think about this, that they can't consider it, you know, a fireable offense if someone at 7:45 does not respond to an email. You know, the implicit assumption can't be that it's the same as a phone call. You know, if you want to speak to somebody immediately, you probably should phone them.
And that's another point. Either, I can't remember if it was you or you quoted somebody raising your book or in your article. We have this alternative technology out there that works better than email for a lot of things, and that's the phone. Have we gotten scared of just picking up the darn phone?
Yeah, I think that the Times wrote a very funny piece about this a few years ago, and I've just noticed a change within my own profession. I don't know if it's true where you are, but my workplace is almost completely silent because no one approaches anybody by phone anymore. They don't make cold calls. They email. So if somebody's doing an interview, it's probably, you know, the exception. Most of our correspondence is, you know, online now. So, I mean, it's very strange, and it probably would behoove us to do it. You did see that in my story. What I said is that if Martians landed on our planet, they would, you know, probably be convinced that we invented email first and not the phone, because email is a much less efficient instrument.
Yeah, I've often come off the end of an email thread where you email and email back and forth, and realize for all the time that took, it would have taken about 40 seconds on the phone.
Exactly.
To convey all the same info.
No, it, exactly. I mean, like, kind of the idiotic back and forthing that you do over which restaurant and where. I mean, it's crazy. Exactly.
But by doing it that way, Rob, I'm wondering if you felt at the time that you were being more efficient because mm-hmm. while you were emailing, you were working on another project, let's say. And how much does that multitasking mentality, Jennifer, play into this?
Well, here's the problem. We're not meant to multitask. You know, we are not very efficient at task switching as a species. So it's probably true that you had some false sense that you were being more productive, but you're not really. I mean, we are kind of neurologically designed not to focus on seven things, even though we can do it. So I think that's fake in a way and sort of misleading.
So you had reference to, we hear a ping and then all of a sudden we drop everything we're doing to go see what that email was. I imagine that one way around that is to turn off your alerts. What other tips do you have for cutting down on the distractions?
I think boundaried hours, you know, that after 6:30, you're not doing this anymore. You know, you're disabling. Some people suggest also that certain rooms are dedicated to work and others are not, but that, like, absolutely no electronic devices at all can be brought into the living room or the dining room. That's one that I haven't yet successfully kind of done within my own family. And, of course, I don't do it, so why would I expect anyone else to do it? But it is a very sane policy. So there's another.
Do you see a cultural backlash in workplaces around the country saying, hey, we're wasting too much time on email, we need to change our expectations?
No. but I'm not really an office ethnographer. But I mean, this isn't the only thing that I write about. And I wonder, you know, if you would start to see that. But any time I've ever spoken to anybody who talks about corporate culture, no. It's always the opposite. It's still an emphasis on acceleration, not deceleration. So, no, I don't see that.
Well, Jennifer, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Jennifer Senior, contributing editor at New York Magazine.
Coming up next, we're going to get another perspective on a story we touched on yesterday. More teachers have lost their jobs since Act 10 became law in Wisconsin. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Yesterday, we spoke to an attorney with the Wisconsin Education Association Council about news from the Oshkosh Northwestern that school districts are letting go of more teachers since Act 10 passed.
Act 10 was part of the controversial budget bill passed a couple years back. It ended collective bargaining rights for most public sector unions in Wisconsin, including teacher unions.
Our guest said teachers are losing their jobs without just cause since Act 10 became law. Now we'll get a different perspective on this story. We're talking to Barry Forbes, Associate Executive Director and Staff Counsel for the Wisconsin Association of School Boards. Barry, welcome to Central Time.
Well, hello.
So is it fair to say that more teachers are being fired since Act 10?
Well, I think it's important first to define what we're talking about when we say fired. Teachers in Wisconsin receive one-year contracts, individual teaching contracts. And, you know, it is possible that employment from one of those contracts might be terminated during the contract term. And I don't think that's what we're talking about here. Typically, we'd be talking about not renewing those contracts. So the teacher would get to complete that contract and then would not be invited to come back the next school year. And in response to your question, are there more of those non-renewals than there used to be? I think the answer would be yes, but with a big proviso. And that proviso would be that most of those non-renewals are for teacher layoff purposes.
Explain that a little bit.
Okay. Before Act 10, layoffs were governed by collective bargaining agreements, and the collective bargaining agreements would specify the procedures under which a teacher would receive a notice of layoff and be laid off from his or her employment. And those teachers would actually receive their individual teaching contracts, so there would not be a non-renewal.
Mm-hmm.
Act 10 prohibits bargaining over layoff clauses and most other wage, hour, and working conditions. And because of that prohibition, a school district that simply needs to employ fewer teachers for economic reasons must now use the non-renewal process to not employ those teachers in the next school year.
Is that legal? Is it fair?
Is that legal and fair? Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And there needs to be a mechanism where a school district that or any employer that needs to reduce staff can do so. And there always has been a mechanism. It used to be the collective bargaining layoff procedure. Now it is the statutory non-renewal process.
So, and we talked to a guest yesterday from WEAC who said that teachers that would never be subjected to termination under just cause standards before are now being let go. Do you think that non-renewals are being handed out fairly? And do you think that the standards are clear to teachers?
Yes, I think the non-renewal process is fair. And those comments probably address two separate sets of concerns that teachers and the unions might have, and they're both important considerations. Under those layoff provisions, layoffs were typically done on the basis of seniority, meaning that the least senior teachers would be laid off first, the more senior teachers would be protected. And following Act 10, school districts could adopt different criteria for selecting teachers for layoff, such as the quality of their evaluations or the other needs of the school district. And that is a change that results in perhaps different teachers being non-renewed for economic purposes following Act 10 than were laid off before Act 10. And that's probably the bigger set, but there are also teachers that were or are being non-renewed or otherwise asked to leave employment with school districts because of their performance or conduct. And that is not a layoff. That would be more traditionally what we might think of as a termination of employment. And those teachers were, most of those teachers were covered by just cause provisions before Act 10. Before Act 10, collective bargaining agreements typically would apply a just cause standard after a teacher was employed by a school district for 2 or 3 years. While they were, before they, during their first 2 or 3 years of employment, the school district had a much greater degree of latitude to non-renew a teacher's contract in that pre-Act 10 world. Following Act 10, school districts set the standards for the non-renewal of teachers' contracts. And teachers, of course, are not without other legal protections. There are employment discrimination laws and other employment laws that effectively require that school districts have a good reason for why they're non-renewing a teacher's contract. But I would agree with what I imagine the union representatives told you yesterday, that that is not the same thing as just cause protection, and school districts would have an easier time non-renewing a teacher for their performance or conduct than they have in the past.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a sense for what kind of feedback teachers are getting before they receive that non-renewal and whether or not the non-renewals are coming as a surprise?
Teachers are required to be evaluated by law, and that's one of those employment protections that I was referring to earlier. If a teacher has not been evaluated and then suddenly finds himself or herself non-renewed, he or she might rightly object to the non-renewal based on the lack of the evaluation. And there have been court cases like that in the past, and school districts have policies governing those evaluation processes, and the courts have said that once a school district adopts a policy, that the school district is expected to follow that policy until it changes it. So the idea that a teacher would be so totally surprised by a non-renewal, I do not believe that to be the case. If a school district's evaluation process is functioning properly, they should know what their supervisors think of them through the evaluation process.
Has Act 10 helped school districts manage their payroll budget more efficiently?
It certainly has given school districts flexibility to do some things that we were unable to do before Act 10.
Like what?
The selection of teachers to be laid off is a great example where we can choose to lay teachers off based on the needs of the district. And just as an example, a teacher with multiple skills and certifications may not be the that was a less senior teacher may have been laid off in the past, and might not be laid off under a school district's current layoff standards.
Mm-hmm. So would you say that Act 10 helps ensure teacher quality by making it easier to let go of teachers for performance reasons?
Well, school districts are, and the teachers, we're all responsible for the teacher quality, and Act 10 gives the school administration and board some tools that we did not have in the past.
So what are teachers saying about the employment landscape since Act 10?
I'm probably not the best person to ask.
Well, let me ask you this. In an ideal world, teachers who've proven themselves would have job security, perhaps like tenure, so that they are free to teach without maybe fear of information and modes of education being penalized. Is that an important provision for a healthy educational environment?
I think that giving school boards and school administrations some latitude over the staff that they use to carry out our educational mission is just as important as that academic freedom argument. And there is just a great deal that is expected of school districts across America right now, and accountability and assessment seem to be the watchwords. And if we're going to be accountable and if we're going to be expected to compete with the private and the voucher and the charter schools, which school districts increasingly are, we need that ability to field the best, most qualified staff we can.
Thanks, Barry, for being with us. That was Barry Forbes, Associate Executive Director and Staff Counsel for the Wisconsin Association of School Boards.
Coming up after the news, we'll talk to the author of a new book about how to be brave. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.